Hello, good day to you. Welcome to Bare Naked Politics. This is the podcast that strips down the news. I forgot what on earth was going on there. This is the podcast that strips down the news and it makes it perfectly easy to understand. So even if you're someone that, you know, really does not declare to be a politics wizard, doesn't matter, you'll still understand everything. I'm Julia Bell and I thought it was necessary to just do a quick debrief, I guess, of COP26. What did they actually agree on? You know, what was this document that they all signed? What's in it? It's actually called the Glasgow Pact, which is a good term for you to remember. And let's just talk about, like, who's happy with it and who's not, because this conference was this huge song and dance. There was so much build-up to it. I feel like we were talking about it for 6 months before it actually happened. Obviously, everyone in Glasgow is probably really glad that it's over because it completely clogged up the city for the whole time. So I think it's important for us at least to have some understanding of what purpose it served. The one bit of news that you probably will have heard was that particularly the final day was very dramatic. And remember, it was all meant to be wrapped up by Friday the 12th of November, but it ran over into the evening of Saturday the 13th. So everyone, you could just tell, everyone in there was just fried. And the thing that kind of dominated the headlines from that last day was essentially the moment that Alok Sharma, who was concluding the conference, who was the president of COP26, he was there ready with his gavel, you know, the little wooden hammer that judges and auctioneers get. He was there ready with that, ready to whack it down and finalise the latest version of the agreement until at the very last second, China and India intervened. And they essentially said, look, we want to change the wording on this one bit of the agreement about coal. Currently, the document says we're all going to aim to phase out coal. We want to change it to we'll aim to phase down coal. And so this last minute change just kind of put everyone who wanted to phase out coal in a really difficult spot because they couldn't. It's not like they could just stay in Glasgow for another week negotiating it further. The conference was over. It was over time. And they also couldn't just pull the plug on the whole thing because A, what a colossal waste of time and money, but also B, this agreement is huge. It includes lots of stuff and they wanted to at least have that. You know, the likes of these island nations who are really suffering already with the impacts of climate change, they need as much action as they can get. So they had no choice really but to take the agreement with these amendments. But my God, did that put a kind of dark cloud on the finale of the summit. And if you don't believe me, have a listen to how Alok Sharma summed it all up at the end. He, of course, like I say, was the president of the COP summit. He's a member of the UK government. He was assigned that job by Boris Johnson. And he basically had to hold himself back from crying.
May I just say to all delegates, I apologise for the way this process has unfolded. I'm deeply sorry. I also understand the deep disappointment. But I think, as you have noted, it's also vital that we protect this package.
So anyway, down that gavel went, bang, this is the agreement, done and dusted, and we'll phase down coal rather than phasing it out. But I suppose the question is, was Sharma just completely exhausted? I mean, there's rumours that he was literally living on Lucozade tablets, you know, those like little energy tablets, and that, you know, the whole thing is just like artificial light for 2 weeks, no sleep, ferrying between rooms, trying to get people to agree, bad coffee and really tough talks. Was he just absolutely knackered and kind of emotional because it was over? And actually, was it quite a fruitful summit? Or should we all be as devastated as he seemed to be? I'll tell you what, I'll run through what the document actually said and you can make your own mind up, as well as answering a couple of your questions directly. If you want to ask me questions, by the way, for future episodes, follow me on social media at juliabell_x. Make sure you're subscribed to the podcast. If you're listening on Spotify, you will see a little bell next to where it says follow. Click them both and that way you'll never miss an episode. All right, so first and foremost, what does this document, the Glasgow Pact, actually say? Or as Nick on Instagram put it, what the fuck actually happened at COP26? Which I think is what we're all asking. So Obviously, you know that the main point of this whole thing was to come together to find a way of keeping global warming at 1.5 degrees C or lower, but I don't think any of us think that that's going to happen. So 1.5 is the magic number. And reportedly, at the rate we're going, we're on track for warming the planet by 2.4 degrees. Not good. And all these climate scientists have laid out these really dark, horrifying pictures of what life will be like if we let that happen. So first things first, each country has committed to essentially getting off that track and achieving net zero emissions. That's point one. But each country has submitted a sort of different timeline. The UK, Australia, Canada, and the US have all said 2050. And frankly, that's been the most popular target. So lots of countries have said 2050. Germany and Sweden have beaten us by 5 years. They've said 2045. Austria and Iceland even beat that. They're saying 2040. Finland, front runners, man. They're saying 2035. Bravo, Finland, if you can do that. So lots of these kind of European countries putting us to shame. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you've got China, the world's biggest emitter, who have committed to 2060. And then India, the third biggest emitter, they've said 2070, which is 20 years later than even us. And we're obviously not the front runners. Now, I'm aware that India are being painted as the sort of big bad wolf of COP26. But their angle on this is, look, we're a developing country. We're not in the same shoes as you, and we can't afford to just eliminate coal right now. In fact, let me quote to you exactly what India's environment and climate minister said. So here it is, quote, "Developing countries have a right to their fair share of the global carbon budget and are entitled to the responsible use of fossil fuels within this scope. In such a situation, how can anyone expect that developing countries can make promises about phasing out coal and fossil fuel subsidies?" So he's kind of saying there, you guys have spent your carbon budget. You know, you in the UK and the US, you've spent it back when you all industrialised. And conveniently, you did that when we didn't know how bad coal was for the environment. So don't rob us of our chance to industrialise now. You're essentially kicking down the ladder, and that's not fair. I mean, that angle hasn't left a lot of people satisfied. I think a lot of people are still royally pissed off, especially by the way that they went about this in that sort of last minute change when everyone was up against the wall. So Switzerland were very quick to voice their disappointment, Fiji as well. Now, you might be asking me about timelines. So we know that coal will be phased down. Do we know when it'll be phased down by? And the answer is not really, no. Outside of the actual net zero target, we're kind of in the dark, and you'll notice that's a theme. Vague language is, I mean, if you turn it into a drinking game, how many times are you going to hear a very non-committal, vague expression in this episode? You'll be drunk by the end. Not that I'm encouraging that, but if you do, I won't judge you. But despite the sort of fact that, yes, we've not got an in-stone timeline and everyone's commitments are a bit different, one thing we do absolutely have from everybody who was there is a promise to come back to next year's COP in Egypt. And not just that, but they're going to come back with stronger and more ambitious commitments to cut down on emissions. Now, you might say that's them just kicking the can along the road and leaving the problem to just pile up on them next year. However, lots of commentators are saying, well, this is a big step. Let's kind of treat that as a win in itself, because A, the pact mentions fossil fuels in the first place. That's never happened before. And B, it's left it open-ended as to how much it's going to promise in the future. So this is a first step. And by everyone promising to come back and be more ambitious, they've set the tone to build momentum. So a kind of attitude of like, Rome wasn't built in a day. Up to you, I suppose, if you're convinced by that. Okay, so that's a few elements of it. Phasing down coal. Oh my God, can you hear this like screaming? Maybe you can't, but I can hear it so loudly. There's a fox somewhere near me screaming. I've heard they make that noise when they mate, so maybe there's some interesting things happening in my garden. But yeah, if you can hear a kind of distant screaming, I hope you know that I haven't kidnapped somebody. I've got a fox in the garden, maybe two, having too much of a good time. Anyway, what are we talking about? Oh yeah, so we've covered a couple of elements of this pact. Number one, we're going to phase down coal and we're all going to commit to net zero. And number two, we are definitely going to come back next year to the COP in Egypt, and we're going to be much more ambitious. We're going to come already with ideas as to how we can do better. Now, the next key area in this pact is all the stuff that talks about money and all the stuff that talks about finance. And if you think about it, rich countries giving poor countries money is important for three reasons, really. Mitigation, so helping them literally prevent climate change, i.e. let's get them onto renewable energy, let's build green technologies in their countries as well as ours, that mitigates emissions. Then there's adaptation, so let's help pay for building things like dams to prevent flooding. You know, the flooding's going to happen, but let's at least put in the infrastructure to adapt to it and to stop, you know, literal cities washing away. And then there's loss and damage. And that's the idea of, okay, we know we're not going to be able to save everything, either by mitigation or adaptation. So really, should we be compensating countries for things that are lost and damaged as a result? Kind of a depressing one, that one, but obviously very important to think about. So those are the three areas that money comes in: mitigation, adaptation, loss and damage. And so let's start with mitigation. This topic was already treated with lots of cynicism because there's already been this long-standing promise by the world's richest countries to put together $100 billion a year to help poor countries with exactly this. And we know that this hasn't even slightly been achieved. And this has been a long-standing promise that we've just absolutely not met. So there was definitely this kind of undertone of, oh, here we go, like rolling eyes. All these rich guys are just going to wave their checkbooks in the air while the cameras are on them. They're going to make a bunch of promises to us, but we're never actually going to see any of this cash. But nonetheless, checkbooks were waved and they said, look, we promise we really will start meeting that commitment, that $100 billion a year. And actually, let's throw around bigger numbers. So they're kind of throwing around the idea of upping it to $1 trillion from 2025. It's not set in stone. Again, nice and vague, but those are the proposed concepts. So we'll see about that. Then there's adaptation. So helping poorer countries build sea defences, proper power grids so that they don't have blackouts as soon as there's a extreme weather, that sort of thing. And in the Glasgow Pact, the rich countries have said, look, we're going to double the funding that's available for adaptation, but we're going to do that by 2025. So we're going to need a bit of time. But by then, you'll be getting around $40 billion a year. So lots of stress on 2025, which is not far away. So the pressure is really on for us kind of completely developed nations, if you want, to get our ducks in a row by then. Because what have we got? 4 years? Less than 4 years to start funding all this stuff, which should be interesting. And that brings me to loss and damage, which is the bit that the likes of these island nations were most focused on. Like, they got to COP26 and they were like, right, let's talk about loss and damage because we are already in need of money because we're already suffering loss and damage. Number one, this pact actually mentions it, which I suppose in itself is a step since that's the first time that's been a thing. Loss and damage has not been mentioned in past agreements. But other than that, to be honest, there's not much more to report. The pact simply commits to a quote-unquote dialogue. So there's another really vague word for your collection. And I suppose it's a fancy way of saying, let's talk about this, but we're definitely not able to make any solid commitments right now. But here's the thing. A lot of these poorer countries on the front line of climate change are really angry about this because a lot of their perspectives is saying, look, this is not charity. We're not asking you for charity. This is compensation. You guys in these rich developed nations, you are rich because, or at least in part, because you industrialized and you burned fossil fuels and you extracted oil and you consumed, you know, unbelievable amounts of fast fashion and plastic non-recyclable goods. And you fucked the planet, right? So this whole nightmare that we are dealing with is literally your fault. And if we have to suffer, then you have to pay for it. We're not asking you for charity that's very kind if you give it to us. We're asking you for compensation, and technically you're committing a bit of a crime if you don't give it to us. It's a very different narrative. And from that, because there's only been mention of it, which I suppose is a step, but there hasn't been a commitment, I am expecting, and so should you, I think, that we are going to see way more of a focus on that in future, at future COPs. Okay, there you go. Really key takeaways there for you. Phasing down coal, promises to come back next year, and promises to be more ambitious next year. Establishing a dialogue on loss and damage, whatever that means. And meeting, if not upping, climate finance commitments from rich countries to poor countries. That right there is your summary. But obviously, there's been loads of stuff. There was lots more checkbook waving, which is the term that I've decided to go with on this. So, for example, there's a big focus on upping the ante in new green innovation and new green inventions. So like the UK, the EU, Japan, and Bill Gates, who I suppose counts as an economy in himself with how much cash he's got in the bank. They've all talked about, let's boost support for innovators who are creating technologies that are going to help us achieve net zero. And then, so lots of that sort of stuff. And then there are also kind of other timeline commitments. So it's not just fossil fuels. Methane, for example, that's a problematic greenhouse gas. It contributes to global warming, and cow farts are massive perpetrators of it. I'm sure you knew that. I feel like it's a fun fact that people talk about. Not fun, but kind of surprising that cow farts are like as bad as certain cars for their impact on the climate. And in this pact, they've said, right, let's cut 30% of methane emissions by 2030. But the big question at the end of all of it is it enough? Is 1.5 degrees overall in global warming still achievable? Or does this pact still push us way over the mark? And I think bottom line, I'm sure you knew this already, but this pact in itself is not enough, nowhere near. If we just go off what's been achieved here, we're not going to manage it. I don't think there's many climate scientists that think we can. I mean, Alok Sharma said, this is a quote from him, "I think today we can say with credibility that we've kept 1.5 degrees Celsius within reach, but its pulse is weak. And we will only survive if we keep our promises." So the pulse of 1.5 is weak, and that's from the president of the thing. The UN chief said the world is, quote, knocking on the door of a climate catastrophe. And activist Greta Thunberg, she said the Glasgow Pact is, quote, watering down the blah, blah, blah. But I think the optimists of the world are seeing this as not a destination, but like as a step towards it. If mistreating the planet was fast food, then we are a big fat guy, okay? But this pact is, or it could be, it's like us signing up to the gym. You know, we're not going to get skinny from this one workout. We're not going to get skinny just by pledging to keep working out. You have to actually keep going back, and you have to keep working out, and you have to keep working out harder every time, and then the weight will fall off. I mean, I took that metaphor really far, but hopefully you get what I'm saying. It's a kick up the arse in momentum, and it is that definitive step that, you know, might make all the difference. We don't know yet, because we've still got to trust all these people to stick to it and up the ante next year. But maybe it's not all doom and gloom. And Boris Johnson very much reflected that sentiment on Sunday, the 14th of November.
"It is beyond question that Glasgow has sounded the death knell for coal power. It's a fantastic achievement, and it's just one of many to emerge from COP26. 90% of the world's economy is now following our lead here in the UK by committing to net zero, ending their contribution to climate change altogether. Don't forget that when Alok took the reins of COP, it wasn't even a third who were committed to net zero. The developed world is finally going to hit the $100 billion climate finance target, if only a bit later than we would have liked."
The death knell for coal, he says. Now, remember though, Boris Johnson really wanted COP26 to be his legacy. So I think Boris Johnson is always going to be quite optimistic when he talks about this, but will he deep down be a bit disappointed by the outcomes? I imagine there's a good chance for that. I had a question from Jamie on Instagram who asked, what, if anything, is legally binding about this pact? Jamie, you're not going to like this, but really nothing. Nothing's legally binding. You can't, it's not very easy to kind of enforce legally binding agreements on an international scale. You can't get like 190-odd countries together and say, you're breaking the law if you don't do this. It doesn't really work like that. But the best you can do is to everyone sign it and then take it home for their own governments to pass into law. So for instance, net zero by 2050 is actually a law here. It's been a law since 2019. I think we were the first country to ever do that, but we're not the last. You know, it's rolling out more and more. I don't know how useful it is to pass it into law, considering, you know, most of the people who made it into a law will not be anywhere near Parliament by the time 2050 rolls around. But it's law, and that, I suppose, means that the government are obliged to try as hard as they can to stick to it, because they'll technically be breaking the law every time they make moves that undermines it. But I suppose the hope is, like I say, that everyone who is at COP26 commits and makes this stuff legally binding on their own turf. I suppose the scary thing, though, is that truly anyone at any time could pull out. And if you're doubtful about that, just think about Donald Trump. He pulled out of the Paris Agreement, which was kind of like a predecessor to the Glasgow Pact, and the two are very much entwined. But it meant that Joe Biden had to sign America back up on his first day in office. So Donald Trump quit the gym and Joe Biden had to sign back up and do the embarrassing kind of walk back in and say, I got fat again. I need to get back on the treadmill. So I suppose in terms of climate activists and climate scientists, they're very much hoping that we don't get more Trumps doing that sort of thing in lots of countries all over the world. Scary, scary how much power a small collection of individuals have. But I suppose I don't want to leave this on a doom and gloom front. It is also kind of invigorating how much of a difference climate activists have made. Remember, they used to be a very niche kind of fringe group, even in my lifetime, of people who, you know, everybody mocked. But now they've turned it into, you know, the climate being a dominating majority opinion that we absolutely need to address it. And it will be a climate crisis if we don't. So I think if it weren't for all these activists and their resilience and relentlessness, even in the face of a kind of public mocking, I don't think that these powerful people would be ratcheting up all their commitments today. Okay, sorry it was a bit of a dry episode, but it was really necessary, so I'm not that sorry. And you've got to let me know what you make of it. Does it all make you want to cry? Or do you actually feel like this is an important step, and if we can pile that pressure on, then next year it'll be a lot better? Maybe you feel both. Maybe you want to cry, but you also feel motivated. I think that tends to be the opinion amongst climate activists. And maybe you have a kind of nuanced view that's somewhere in the middle. That seems to be the opinion, to be honest, that this pact isn't nothing, but it's nowhere near good enough. But let me know. Reach out on social media at @JuliaBell_X. And just to say, obviously you guys can reach out and ask me questions. Obviously, I'm sure you know, I don't take questions from people who don't follow me. I've had a few people ask me very demanding questions that they want me to answer on my podcast, and they do not follow me on social media. And if you can pain yourself to make the free and quick commitment to follow me, then you've got more of a chance of me going out of my way to educate you. I hope that's a fair request. And if you want to keep this podcast going, and if you want to support it and make sure that, you know, I can keep it up, then please become a patron. The link is in the episode description for that. And recently, I wrote a piece that is getting great feedback. I wrote a piece about how Boris Johnson reminds me of a bad boyfriend. So if you want to have a read of that, as well as loads more other content that you can unlock, then the only way to do it is to become a patron. And then, of course, you keep the podcast going. It's literally the price of a coffee every month. So it's nothing. It's pennies. And on that, thank you so much for listening. I hope you guys are looking after yourselves. And I hope this wasn't too bleak. And keep in touch with me. Tell me what you want to hear next. And I'll do that for you next time. All right. Goodbye.